Group meeting, Sunday, 2nd October, 1983. I think you will all agree that generally speaking, human beings are occupied with themselves all the time. Their whole consciousness is a self-oriented consciousness. And as a result of this self-oriented consciousness, there is this everlasting duality, the self and the not-self. And the self, which is the particular person, always thinks in terms of obtaining some benefit for himself, fulfilling some pleasure, some ambition, and so forth. And he finds that his environment, the rest of humanity and the world in general, is hostile to him on the whole. Very rarely someone will be will really cooperate with him. So this situation of self and not self is a situation of constant conflict. And because of this constant conflict in each individual, there is, of course, disorder, disharmony throughout the world. The tendency of the individual is to think of himself as being right, as being good, and as a person to whom all that he desires for himself is due to him. Now see, we start off with colossal errors in our outlook and consequently also in our understanding. Therefore, it is almost impossible to bring about a state of harmony for society. Now, those of us whose concern is religious living must necessarily understand that such being the situation, we should have a clear idea of what the word religion means, as practically all of you, certainly most of you know already. We are not concerned here with an intellectual satisfaction for the satisfaction of an intellectual curiosity. We are concerned with living the religious life, and that does not necessarily mean living the religious life in the conventional sense of the word in the world. It means essentially just this: whatsoever purifies the person, the psyche and the body, whatsoever relates him rightly with his environment, and whatsoever enables him to realize transcendence, use the word God if you like, to realize that unio mystica, that unity with the source from which we come, that is religion. It has nothing to do with merely subscribing to a set of beliefs, dogmas and doctrines and systems of thought and philosophy and so forth. It is how we live, not what we just believe. Sometimes, of course, people do live according to their beliefs, but on the whole, people do not. If they did, then the state of the world would not be what it is now. Now, this relating back to the source from which we come. What is this source? We have given it many names throughout the centuries. Generally, it has been the idea of a personal, superhuman, transcendent being who is the creator, the author of the universe, as we say, and who runs, governs the universe. Well, if that is the case, the government of the universe is a little bit more of a disturbance than an orderly government. We find galaxies colliding and all sorts of terrific things happening. And whilst we talk of the music of the spheres and the harmony of the whole cosmos, in actual fact, we see a very considerable turmoil everywhere, all through, both in the cosmos as a whole and in our own world on this planet and in our own lives. But it is interesting to consider for a moment the names, the attributes rather, which have been given to the creator of the universe. I'll use the word God because it is a monosyllable and it is very simple and easy to use. God is declared to be omnipotent, omniscient, and omnipresent. Now, omnipotence is perhaps necessarily associated with the idea of power. Power which is creative energy. Omniscience involves consciousness, to know everything, to be all-knowing. But in which sense the creator is all-knowing or the creative energy is all-knowing is something which we do not understand clearly at all. Omnipresence is easier to conceive of. And although it is easy to conceive of it, practically no one lives in such a manner that shows that he is really aware of the omnipresence of the Supreme, of the ultimate controlling power. Because if we were aware, our behavior, I'm talking of the whole world, our behavior would be quite different from what it has been throughout human history so far, and is at present, and is likely to continue for quite a long while yet. Now, this point about the omniscience of the Creator. This omniscience is decidedly not encyclopedic knowledge. When we use the word knowledge, that word has a specific meaning in relation to us human beings. We know this, that, or the other in the sense that we have acquired a great many facts about this, that, or the other subject or technique or whatever the matter may be. We know how to cook. We have knowledge about cooking. We know how to make clothes. We know how to make engines. We know algebra, we know chemistry, we know physiology, and all that sort of thing. But it is not that sort of knowledge at all which is involved with omniscience. Perhaps the most cryptic and perhaps the most complete statement in this direction comes in the statement in the Bible that not a sparrow falleth to the ground, but my Father in heaven knoweth it. Now, are you and I at all interested in sparrows falling to the ground? And if a sparrow fell to the ground, would we know it? And probably millions of sparrows fall to the ground each day. But does any one of us know anything about it? And why not? This is not due to ignorance in our definition of the word ignorance. It is due to the fact that our consciousness is confined to the sphere of the finite, the temporal, and the mortal. And it is confined to that state of affairs in us and around us which is directly concerned with our self-centered interests. But if one can see that consciousness in the supreme sense is something which belongs to the context of the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal, then that knowing, then the knowing by that consciousness is of a completely different nature from what we mean by knowing. Consciousness in that sense means being that of which you are conscious. So whatsoever happens in that transcendent, in that transcendent sense is necessarily known because the creative power, the supreme being, is that event. Which is quite a different thing, isn't it? Utterly different. There is no particularity involved. There is no movement of time involved. There is no distance in terms of space involved. Here, there, today, yesterday, today, tomorrow are all here now immediately. In that immediacy of space-time and that infinity and eternity of consciousness, then whatsoever has happened, as we call it, is happening and will happen, is all there simultaneously. Now it seems to me that this is the fundamental, the primary meaning of the unitary wholeness, that supreme holiness, if you like, of the totality. That supreme source, the primordial, undifferentiated creative energy, holds within itself all that has emerged, is emerging, and can emerge. So that whatever words we use to describe anything and everything, good, bad, indifferent, is all there at once, in its fullness. In a sense, this is a terrible, terrible thing to say or to think of, because it implies that heaven, hell, everything is there at once, in what we, in the ordinary way, have believed or like to believe is all pure and good and wonderful, paradisical and so forth. Nothing of the sort. The nature of that actuality, the actuality of that totality, is something which it is very, very difficult for the human brain to picture, to imagine, and certainly to accept or understand. It's very difficult. But what is the reason for that difficulty? The reason is just this. I, the ordinary man, am a self-centered, self-oriented being. I am a subhuman yet. Haven't grown to full humanity. Because I am like that, there is so much involved in the actuality of what the totality is repugnant to me. It hurts me. Therefore, I don't like it. It doesn't serve my desires, my whims, my passions, my ambitions, all my ego-driven, vanity-driven activities in the world to do this, that, and the other, which is good for everybody, without having the capacity to do much which is good for myself, even. You see? It is because of that that we find it so difficult really to be conscious of what of the actuality as it is. It takes a lifetime to get just a thrill of that transcendence and what it implies, and to be able to stand that thrill. Because if one isn't sufficiently strong within oneself, that is to say, sufficiently quiet, peaceful, ready to, open-minded, if one isn't like that, one is completely shattered. This has happened actually in human history, time and time again. We have often heard in India, for instance, of yogis who enter into the deep states of meditation and glimpse these tremendous realities of the actual supreme power and creative energy, and as a result they die. It's too much for the organism. The organism is shattered. Just as if, for instance, I'm walking in the street and there's a thunderstorm and lightning strikes me, it would kill me. At least it certainly could kill me. Isn't that so? It's like that. The lightning of transcendence is something which can shatter. It is something which, if you, the vessel, are ready to receive that lightning, will make you realize heaven immediately here now. But if you realize heaven immediately here now, you will also realize hell immediately here now. You know why? Because if you are sufficiently purified as to receive the shock of transcendence in its full state, you will have to accept it in its fullness, which includes all our dualities and all our multiplicities. You know, we have a saying in India, before you try to look directly at the sun, see to it that your eyes are strong enough to stand that sunlight. Otherwise you'll be blinded. And in ancient days in China, one of the cruel legal punishments was to fix a board, or rather two pieces clamped together around a man's neck in such a way that he couldn't do anything about it, and that board would move with the sun, so that he was always facing the sun until he got blind day after day. So you see, before we can ask for the revelation, we must be capable of absorbing the fullness of that revelation. Otherwise, the chances are that it will be troublesome to us. So now we have to consider the implications here. Why are we what we are? When we talk of ourselves as we refer to the organism as such, the psychophysical organism. And the psychophysical organism has an animal ancestry. The primates split into two parallel lines, the pongids and the hominids. We are the result of the line of development along the line of the hominids as such. But we hold within ourselves, by heredity, the effects of the evolution through the reptilian and mammalian stages of our development. The reptilian stage is actually present in our own brain, the brain stem is surrounded with a layer which has evolved out of that reptilian stage, and that is surrounded by the mammalian stage brain, and then up here the cortex is the purely human. Now the reptilian brain in us is the one that carries hereditarily fear, aggressiveness, cruelty, and all such qualities. The mammalian is the one that introduces affection and care for the young. So we start off with, as we say, loving our own children, our own families. And this is the interesting point, we identify ourselves with our children. We are reborn in our children. Look at Papa's pride when his first son is born and Mama's delight after the pains. There are always pains involved everywhere, and so forth. So this starts off in this limited sphere, and then only from the family it extends to the tribe, and then to the social group, the nation, and so forth. But that extension rarely takes place in human beings as a whole. It comes about, so slowly. On the other hand, there is also this fact. Whilst we look at ourselves from the standpoint of matter and its development onwards, we talk as the scientists talk. Or we can start from the other end, the other shore, the transcendent creative energy itself right at the beginning. Now remember, this creative energy is not only energy, it is consciousness, it is fundamental substance, it is love, it is beauty, it is truth, it is anything and everything that you can think of. This is the difficult part of the whole story. We ask, how can it be that? This book, for instance, you say, is just a book. Yes, so it is. But this is a book. This is not the transcendent creative source of the universe. Now, this transcendent energy, acting as pure energy through substance in consciousness, constricts itself all the way down to solid matter. And then comes the upward arc, as we call it. The upward arc. And in man, consciousness at last begins to be capable of transcending the limitation imposed upon us by our own particular organism. The animals can't do it. We can do it. Trees can't do it. And certainly stones and the earth and so forth can't do it. But we can do it. We can begin to be cooperators with that transcendent process of the upward arc. Now, do realize, it is not you or I who achieves anything. There is nothing for me at all. There is nothing which is my realization or my fulfillment or anything. It is transcendence which fulfills itself through me if I make myself a fit apparatus for that realization. Transcendence realizes its own transcendence as perfect humanity through the perfected Holy One. Through a Buddha, through a Yajnavalkya, a Jesus, a Zarathustra, a Krishna, or beings like that. It is through such beings that transcendence realizes its own self transcendentally as the perfect human. And that is all there is. The organism, the particular individual through whom this happens, he of course was born, or she was born, grew up, went through all this, and it happened that there was the realization of becoming the perfected Holy One, and then dies. Not a single one of us can escape death. Not a single separate particular entity can escape death. And at death, what happens is that that particular identifiable entity totally loses its identifiability. We have natural phenomena which can help us to understand that, to have a feel for that. Take a shower of rain, the raindrops. As a result of the rain, you have streams, you have great rivers, you have lakes, and so forth. And the streams and the rivers finally end up in the sea, in the ocean. Has that stream any further identity after that? Do the countless millions of raindrops which fall into the ocean manage to preserve a separate identity? Not at all. Now you see, our difficulty is this. We being what we are, and our language and our brains and everything function in that way, there is this very insistent clinging to the perpetuity of the I, the ego. You know what that really means? It means that we do not want to grow to our true fulfillment. Our true fruition, I mean. The ego stage is a necessary stage. Every single human being who is born and lives, it is necessary for him to realize true egohood. True egohood means the harmony of the whole of the separate individual organism as such. The body and the psyche are in perfect harmony. The masculine elements and the feminine elements which are in the psyche, everyone's psyche, man or woman, has both masculine and feminine elements. These have to be harmonized. When these are in harmony, the first marriage made in heaven is realized. This is the first meaning of it. There are profounder and profounder meanings as we grow. Now, The trouble with the human race is just this, that it clings to this ego stage. And it clings, unfortunately, not to the healthy, the perfected ego stage, but it clings to the unhealthy ego stage, the egoistic stage. I am the king of the castle, as all the children shout and scream, you see. But it's perfectly right for them. They are the kings of the castle which is not there. So, it is like that, you see. But we cling to this, unfortunately, and we find ourselves in constant conflict with our total surrounding. Now, when we realize that this type of egoism manifests in the world in terms of what we commonly call and justifiably and rightly call all the vices as such, our greeds and our hates and our passions and our fears, our violence, our delusions and so forth, and it functions like that, those fires make up the fires of hell here and now in our life on earth. Now, seeing that very clearly, it becomes possible for such fires to reach their extinction. Note what I say, to reach their extinction. You can, of course, in the ordinary way, if there's a fire burning, you put water on it and you can extinguish the fire. But the fires which burn in our own psyche are not extinguished in that manner at all. The water, if you carry the analogy far enough, the water which extinguishes those fires in us are the waters of calm, dispassionate, not seeking for the self, observation. That is the water which is the healing water. It heals because it quenches those fires. And when those fires are quenched, are brought to their extinction, then one has gone past sticking at this egoistic stage, this stage of conflict and so forth. But you see, in order to do that, one has to be prepared totally, totally to relinquish all self-perpetuity. There is absolutely nothing whatsoever for this psychophysical organism. What it has to do is to fulfill its duty in the universal scheme, in the whole cosmic scheme. And its duty is to help in bringing these fires to extinction. And if it does that, then here and now in this life, the organism, the person as we call him, realizes that state of mind, that condition of ineffable peace, that beatitude of the experience of complete unity with the total, with the unitary whole, which is the totality of the transcendent itself. That is there for us, which means, therefore, that our stupid idea of the perpetuity of the self after death in some mythical hereafter and so forth, that is not true, but the real nature of immortality is experienced here and now. That is a fact. You may ask me, have I any evidence for the fact? None. You find out for yourself. Because you see, supposing I were to say, yes, I have realized it, you may believe me, which means that you are simply tied yourself up in a prison house of mere belief. And then if you find that, it doesn't work with you or some such thing, what will be your reaction towards me? If you don't believe it, well, you will be free, the mind will be free to investigate for itself. And only what you investigate for yourself and realize in your own innermost consciousness is truth. Everything else is not the truth. Is not the actual fact. It has to be personal realization. So, when you are truly conscious of this this kind of thing, then your entire existential life, your organic life in thought and feeling, word and deed, will naturally, spontaneously, invariably and inevitably express that realization. If you are truly conscious of love, if you are truly conscious of wisdom, not merely have an idea about love or of wisdom or anything, but if you are truly conscious of it, you are actually consciously wielding this supreme transcendent creative energy. You are actually wielding it. And you will find that the result will be that your every thought and feeling, your every word and action will express love, wisdom, truth, beauty, goodness, whatever it is. It will do so. And, funnily enough, and rather charmingly enough, the brain will not know it. If somebody tells you that you are the very embodiment of love, you'll say, what? I am just myself. Well, that is it. You are just yourself in the supreme sense of the word self. The self which is the one and only transcendent self throughout the cosmos. The supreme I am, the Atma of the Upanishads.